ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is James Norman, the CEO and co-founder of Pilotly, a consumer insights platform that empowers content creators to get feedback from audiences at scale. The platform provides insights to the NBC Universal family, Ovation TV, Otter Media, and others. Over the past 8 years in the media and entertainment industry, he's become a thought leader in over-the-top media and consumer video consumption behaviors. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
For listeners who don't know what Pilotly is, could you just describe a little bit what the service is?
We help video creators get consumer or viewer information so they can make better business decisions. And we do this through like a self-service platform where people can launch these online video studies and people can go access them on any device. So they can securely get feedback. So like people can put shows on there that haven't even been out yet. And we collect the right target audience to get the information that someone needs to hopefully make their show more successful or find distribution for it.
So one of the biggest challenges I imagine in doing this is precisely that platform and the users who are essentially becoming that representative panel of whatever the demographics are that the people who provide the content are coming to you for. Mm-hmm. How do you generate the interest in your platform for viewers? How do you ensure that you have the samples that you need?
Well, we oftentimes are working with partners who focus on cultivating audiences and making sure that it's not a lot of the repeat kind of survey specialists. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as people come into our platform, we have verified their demographics and we have some of our own algorithms that go out and verify their employment status and things like that using Google, LinkedIn, Twitter, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. That's how we do that. And, you know, our pool is wide enough where, for the most part, like even last week, we had a study where someone was like, we need people who like quilting. And, you know, that's probably like the most specific
thing
we've done. Yeah, it's pretty narrow, right? And so I was like, okay, well, you know, let's see what we can do. You know, with 24 hours, we had 100 people that quilt. So
okay.
These people are self-selected, right? Like they come in, they say, I like, you know, we ask them, which one of these crafts do you like? It's a list of 10 different things, you know, and people are like, oh, I like quilting. You know, it's an example of how we kind of narrow things down. And we check zip code for geography. So we try and get like an even distribution of people. We don't want everybody from New York. We don't want everybody from Nebraska, you know?
Right. Although it's interesting, I wonder, I mean, when somebody picks something as narrow as quilting, the other dimensions, I would say, you know, how specific can they get? I mean, get like your age ranges and your geographies. I mean, it may be that you have pockets of rabid quilting enthusiasts, you know?
Absolutely.
I don't know that you're going to have as broad.
It's not going to be as broad a spectrum for that. So, I mean, it just depends on the study. Some people are looking for something more niche and like targeted in terms of area. Other people are like, you know, we're a national TV channel or we're a national brand that's advertising across the US. We need a representative sample.
So, I mean, it seems there might almost be a chicken and egg problem, you know, or at least when you were starting. Now that you're going, you have a going concern and people know what it is. But when you first went to market and you were talking to the content creators mm-hmm. and saying, I've got this service, how did you know that you could collect the panel quickly enough so that you could turn it around? Did you already have a panel? And how do you get a panel who's going to be interested in looking at content if you don't have any content to show them yet? I mean, how did that work?
So previously, this company was called Groupflix.
Okay.
It's an a la carte TV service. And so we had a couple thousand people signed up.
Okay.
With credit cards to come to our website to watch a la carte television.
Right.
You know, we had to get the content to do a la carte TV, we had to go out and get contracts from studios. And those contracts require what they call minimum guarantees. And we had got the lowest minimum guarantees anyone had ever got because we were guaranteeing a certain amount of volume as well. But the investors that said they would be helping us if we got the contracts, they never showed up. We went back to the studios, both apologetic, but also just, you know, trying to tell them a little bit about the story of what we were planning to do. And that story was about offering them analytics, right? So like when people do their, when people like do secondary distribution to like Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, these people like this, they're not getting any data back, right? So they don't know how that content's performing. They can't use that information to better their future productions or anything like that. So when I had that conversation, that's when they told me about traditional focus groups, you know, pulling people off the street in Vegas and putting them in a room, mall testing. That's when I learned about all this. And I was like, oh, this stuff still takes place. And they're like, yeah, we've been doing this way since the 60s.
Because that's the way we've always done it. That's what we're going to keep doing.
And so I was like, well, that kind of doesn't make sense because we don't drive the same cars, eat the same food, or do the same anything since the 60s. So it's kind of like, you know, that's when we were like, well, if we can provide you a more efficient solution, then they're like, well, if you can do it, sure. You know, so that's kind of how that all came about. And so essentially when we started, we had a couple thousand people from various backgrounds. And then we eventually figured out the idea of partnering up with different companies that either manage panels, that's their entire business, or they simply have an audience that matches a particular demographic we might want to tap into. Like you might have a magazine that has 100,000 subscribers that are all women who like home improvement, right?
Right.
And so I can pay them to offer their people the opportunity to see something that they're going to have an opinion about because it's within their topic range. Mm-hmm. As far as getting people to join our platform directly, people want their opinion heard.
Is there any issue with, you know, confidentiality?
Well, yeah, that's always a concern. So, I mean, we have a lot of different security measures.
Right. I see. Okay. Interesting. So how, when you, I mean, you summed it up in such a quick little sentence, this pivot from Grouplex to Pilotly, was it really that smooth, that simple, that easy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was that simple. It was like, holy shit, no one's done anything in this market for 50 years. And why am I going to go chase after doing content distribution when there's 1,000 different people thinking they know how to do that? No one was thinking, I need to build new solutions for getting viewer feedback on video. Like, no, you know, that is not on the top of anybody's mind. And so it was just an open opportunity for us to apply technology we basically had already built and, you know, to kind of like take over a market. We were always interested in getting data to that. That's where the money was at, right? Because that's our IP. Content is the creator's IP. Like anybody who's running a business where they're not creating their own IP and they're just paying for other people's stuff, it's not a real business.
Changing gears a little bit, looking at your LinkedIn profile, it looks like you started your first business when you were 14 or so, I'm guessing.
Yep, that's about right.
That's and funny. It looks like
that's
it was
a good guess.
A website where you sold car products online, and then another company in college, and then some time at Mitsubishi, and then you started Ubi Video, which was a startup, and then you sold that to a MVPD, and then Grouplex.
Yep.
Is that correct?
Yep.
So were you always interested in starting businesses, and are you really looking to sort of flip into something different?
Yeah, I mean, it's always what I've been doing my whole life.
Right.
At age 14, at that point, I don't think you can get a job at 14. So
no.
I just need to create a way to make money. How are you supposed to buy a car when you're 16 if you don't have money? You can't get a job until you need, and then you need a car to get to your job, but you can't afford to buy a car, right? It doesn't make sense. I should be able to work before I can drive.
How do you then go from cars to entertainment?
That's a long story. Like, so I'm from, you know, I'm from Lansing, Michigan, Detroit, right? So I grew up in a car culture. So I grew up building cars, doing car audio shows, stuff like that. And so we ended up in a situation where we had some capital and we were like, what if we could build whole cars? And then we started building concept cars and show cars for manufacturers. So that became a business. And that business took me to LA. So, you know, in 2006, you might find me in LA with like a parking lot of 10 cars. And so we would keep doing that every year. But what happened was because I had all these cars, people like Fast and the Furious started calling and they'd be like, can you bring like 5-year cars through?
Oh, wow.
The proximity to Hollywood drew my mind to potential of working in entertainment.
Right.
And then the recession hit, right? So automotive wasn't even as hot anymore. So it was like, what is still hot is entertainment. Entertainment never dies. And so that was 2008, especially with the recession, was about the pivotal point where it became clear that cable TV wasn't the future. Because people were cutting cable because it was too expensive, but I knew that people wouldn't come back because the experience was terrible. And so that's when we started building Yubi to replace the cable experience. Now, I didn't know anything about television at the time, so obviously, like, I didn't understand how far-fetched an idea that was. But
so you didn't know you couldn't
we learned
do it.
A lot. right. Like, and that's what you're supposed to do with a startup. We built the first online three-dimensional like channel guide. We built like the first cloud DVR. Like, we built a lot of stuff, but didn't know anything about, like, we're just very new to an actual tech startup. Not e-commerce, not selling stuff online, but actually building like technology and then like positioning yourself to like get funding and to sell it.
Are you a coder? Are you
personally?
Like,
I wasn't when I started Yubi.
Are you now?
So when I started Yubi, I didn't know how to code. I know how to design cars, but it did not translate to online. But I learned how to design. And then once I realized I couldn't afford developers, I learned to code. And then I built the third version of the product. And we actually had a few thousand people using it for a year. And that got me into a program that brought me to San Francisco. I was like living in a house with seven other minority founders building my product every day under the guidance of, you know, like pretty big people. Like, first day I showed to my house, Mitch Kapor is in the living room. Then 2 weeks later, people like Ben Horowitz are at dinner with us. And so we met a lot of people. I got a lot of mentorship. And Ben actually gave me the know-how, how to position my company to get acquired.
Wow. That's fantastic. What an amazing, amazing story. One of the things I'm curious about is, you know, so you go from cars to tech, all self-taught, all self-motivated with wonderful mentors along the way, but still it's a lot of will to power on your own. One of the things that's been challenging when we look at big companies is the culture of tech companies versus the culture of entertainment companies. And they don't always mesh very well.
Oh, that's a huge thing. Silicon Valley is an engineering first culture. Hollywood is a creative first culture. Neither respects either one. And so Pilotly sits in between. Although Silicon Valley is getting a little bit more respect for creatives because of becoming more prevalent. And that kind of bleeds into design a little bit. And so they're getting a little more respect there. But, you know, in Hollywood, these people do not care about the engineers. They're basically like IT workers to them. They're not thinking of them as people who are kind of creatively building things.
How have you dealt with that in creating your own culture?
To a certain point, like, there's always like 25% luck, you know, 25% blessings. That's all it is. Like, literally, I was pitching Groupflix 3 years ago. Sky Hector was in the crowd, saw me pitch. Then like a year and a half later, when I'm deciding to build Pilotly, one of our first investors met him at a Latino Codes event. And he was saying, hey, I'm looking at investing in a company called Pilotly. Have you heard of them? And Hector's like, I use Pilotly. I'm one of the users. He's like, of course I want to join that company. And then he becomes our CTO. So
Wow.
Hector's also an actor. So like, Hector's been on like Modern Family, Blackish. He was on a pilot for Amazon. So it's just like, there's a bit of serendipity in finding people who are Harvard CS grads who are actors. Right?
that's a heck of a lot of serendipity. Yeah.
So I can't say like we've found a clever way to create this cross culture between the two. It's just been like a matter of chance at this point that we have people who have roots in either like advertisement creative, but they're also engineers, or they're actors and engineers. Like, everybody on our team is an engineer, but they also have like some sort of creative outlet that they do. So I guess I would say like, that's a requirement for us at this stage. Like, if you come on the team, we want you to have a creative side.
One of the other things that's different about your company is that you are minority, that you did, I mean, you mentioned that earlier about sort of the mentoring earlier. I mean, you know, the industry is pretty not minority.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, just a bit.
Yeah, I mean,
I mean, I was at a conference and I looked around and I was like, wow, it's white guys. And maybe the conference I was at, I think there was maybe 23% women, and maybe there were three black guys, no black women. So how has that been? And how has that affected? I mean, does that does having diversity of culture and background that you bring just by virtue of your own personal background and people on your team, does that change how things come together?
It changes the game on all sides. It's a lot for me to explain. Like, I can say that it's intentional that we always try and hire someone that doesn't look like anybody else on the team. Mm-hmm. Because we're in research and we want to have different perspectives. I think, you know, there's a lot of chatter going on right now about diversity in tech and tech inclusion. And so It's really a matter of timing that we are the ideal makeup of a company that people wish they could have. Because five years ago, it wouldn't have made any, nobody would have cared.
Right.
If you took our team and put us in a room, you know, add a couple more people, you know, you could probably represent, you know, not statistically significantly, but you could represent the general viewing TV audience. Although we don't have the women to do that. We need more women. That's on my docket. Any women engineers who want to talk to me? Yeah. Definitely looking for that.
Interesting.
Like, people who join our company, they don't join the company because they're going to make a lot of money, because we can't pay people a lot of money right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They join because they're comfortable in their setting, right? Like, You know, we had someone who was applying who had no gender identity. She was they were comfortable, you know, so like, I had to adjust my, I'm willing to adjust the way I'm communicating to fit what they need. Right. Or, you know, Person who, you know, is a first generation immigrant from Mexico, like, his English isn't 100% perfect, but he can feel comfortable working on his communication skills, you know? Because he can code the hell out of something. Creating an environment where people are comfortable from different backgrounds and can all like communicate on their own level is like key, and it keeps people engaged. That drives people. Like, the job is cool and they love what they're doing, but ultimately, like, this is all for the culture. And if we're successful, it's going to like change the trajectory of other people's lives. When we started Groupflix, my best friend, who is a white guy from MIT, he literally joined the team to ensure that there could be no situation where someone looked at the team and said, well, I don't know, I haven't seen anybody like this do this before.
He was your token white guy.
Right, right. He's known me for almost 2 decades, and he's seen me build crazy stuff and not get anywhere because we can't get access to money. And he was like, this is crazy. I'm just going to be there.
Wow. That's really, that's heartbreaking.
Right. There is a factor of comfort when I come in the room with him with certain people. And so That instant comfort allows me to just be me. And then they're super comfortable because they're like, damn, this guy came with him. He's comfortable with him. I'm comfortable with him. Like, this whole triangle works. You know, like, If I come in solo, they're initially shocked, right? If I come in with him, they're like, oh, look at this team of people. These guys are having fun. I should be having fun too.
It gives them somebody they understand. Sure.
Exactly. And so I'm not saying people should go out there and find a white co-founder at all, but I'm just saying, like, when you go into a room and you're planning on seeing people who aren't like you, you got to find ways to make them comfortable. You can break through those barriers.
Right. That's fascinating. So what's the next thing for you? I mean, it seems like you are a serial entrepreneur. You like building and challenging yourself and moving along. What excites you? What's the next big thing for you?
You know, I'm just excited about the product. Like, we have a lot of great clients who are, you know, diehard fans of what we're doing.
Well, thank you so much. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, James Norman. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.